Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance so you can protect your tandem bike on the go.
Thief!
Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back. Or if you're new here, welcome. Today I want to share a story with you based here in the UK, one of my favourite cities in the whole world, Brighton. This is the case of the Brighton Trunk Murders. It's a historical case, now 88 years old, and refers to the murders of two women, each with their bodies placed in trunks. Investigators eventually thought they'd found the answers to the second of these murders, with the suspect being arrested and sent to trial, but he ended up being found not guilty. So technically, even the second case here does remain unsolved. And in a bizarre twist, it would seem that the first body found had absolutely no connection to the second. These were two completely unrelated, very similar murders in the same city within just a couple of months of each other. Our story begins on the 17th of June 1934 at Brighton train station, when a man called William Joseph Finnicum noticed a bit of a smell. In searching around for the source of this smell, he came across a plywood trunk that had been left unclaimed in the luggage office. And William wasn't stupid, he knew the possibilities of what could be inside that trunk causing the horrible, horrible smell, so he very quickly alerted the authorities to come and open it for themselves. Chief Inspector Robert Bob Donaldson was the one who turned up for the job, and sure enough, inside the trunk, he found the dismembered torso of a woman, slowly rotting. She was wrapped in brown paper tied with 6 yards of Venetian blind cord. The head and limbs were nowhere to be found, it was literally just the torso, and the only clue found in the trunk was a word written in blue pencil on the paper. However, the blood soaking through the brown paper had obscured half the word. All they could decipher was the second half, which was Ford. And to this day, the clue has never been figured out. We don't even know if it was much of a clue at all. Investigation found that the suitcase had been dropped at the luggage office on the 6th of June, so 11 days before it was found. This was a derby day that day. There were lots of people travelling through Brighton Station to get to Epsom for the derby. Therefore, when the luggage room clerk was asked for any more details about who left this trunk, he wasn't really able to remember any details. All he knew was that it had been dropped off in the late afternoon. None of this really boded very well for the Brighton police, who knew there was just as much chance of somebody from outside the city being the one to leave the trunk as anyone living inside the city. They basically had no clue, it was looking for a needle in a haystack. So investigators sent out alerts to other train stations across the country, telling cloakroom attendants to keep an eye out for anything strange. The notice reached King's Cross Station in London, where just the very next day they opened a trunk themselves to find a pair of legs, which were very much immediately assumed to belong to the woman's torso found in Brighton. When the press managed to get hold of this story, they dubbed the unidentified victim the girl with the pretty feet, and later just Pretty Feet, because the story goes the body had dancer's feet the people thought were beautiful. And that's all she would ever be known as, because she never got identified. Her arms and head were never found. Clearly the killer wanted to play a game. They wanted there to be intrigue and mystery around this death, hence leaving the torso and legs where they would undoubtedly be found. But the head and the arms and hands, through which she could have potentially been identified through people just recognising her or through her fingerprints, they were never found. The killer had had the presence of mind to dispose of those properly. The authorities Authorities did what they could to try and identify her, though, with a post-mortem conducted by Sir Bernard Spilsbury, who was a very, very famous doctor. He was famously an expert witness in murder trials across the country. He was thought to have carried out over 20,000 autopsies in his time, and this was coming towards the end of his career. He first examined the woman's torso in Brighton on the 19th of June before travelling up to London the very next day to establish that the legs definitely belonged to the same body. He found that the unidentified woman was about 25 years old, at least between 21 and 28. She was 5'2" and 8.5 stone. She was very well nourished and was 5 months pregnant at the time of her death. The question was the fetus related to her murder? Was she potentially murdered by the father? Was she a mistress and he was scared of being found out? Was this just another case of domestic violence increasing in pregnancy? Or had she been seeking to end the pregnancy? Sir Bernard definitely had his own suspicions about who he thought was responsible for the unidentified woman's death, pointing the finger at a local abortionist called Dr. Edward Messiah from Hove, which is right next to Brighton. Spilsbury had reasons for thinking it was somewhat of a professional. The legs had also been wrapped in brown paper, like the torso, along with some newspaper as well. But interestingly, all of this paper had been soaked in olive oil, something that was sometimes used by surgeons at this time to stem bleeding. Olive oil wasn't exactly a common ingredient back then in cooking. Even chefs and restaurants would have struggled to be able to afford it, and they often used lard in their cooking instead. So from Spilsbury's point of view, this had to be a medical professional or adjacent. That was also thought in the early days because of the dismemberment. I mean, most regular people wouldn't even know where to begin with dismembering a human body. It had to be somebody in the medical field. Messiah, as I said, was an abortionist, a person who would carry out backstreet abortions in a time before abortions were legal here in the UK. It was speculated this woman could have died in one of those backstreet abortions, and Messiah was just trying to cover his tracks. On Spilsbury's word, the police started to trial Messiah, keeping a very close eye on him, but eventually one officer confronted him, asking him to come into the station. Messiah responded to the accusation by writing a list of names. A list of names, from what I can gather, were just a list of his patients, and they were big, powerful names in the area. Many powerful men would send their mistresses to Messiah for abortions, and as a result of this, the officer never reported that he'd approached Messiah to his superiors. I can only assume that some of his superiors' names were on that list. Shortly after this, Messiah left for London, where a woman actually did end up dying whilst he was performing an abortion. He was never prosecuted for this woman's death though, nor for carrying out abortions. I can assume again because of maybe the powerful people that he provided his service to. But he was never really a serious person of interest in the Brighton case though, and investigators soon moved on from him as a suspect. There was no actual evidence, only the fact that Spilsbury had pointed his finger in his direction. Despite the dismemberment of the body, investigators would soon start to look away from anyone in the medical field. It was said that it wasn't done with any particular skill or knowledge of anatomy. It was just kind of hacked away. Also, the examination of the torso showed no actual evidence of an abortion or attempts to end the pregnancy, so that line kind of ended there. Eventually, a woman came forward claiming that she recognised the paper that had been used to wrap the legs at King's Cross. Or more so, she recognised some writing on the paper. She said that was her, she'd written that, she'd sent this paper to a sweets factory and had no idea how it ended up being used how it was. Although this was something at the time, this lead wouldn't prove to be very helpful at all. That line again kind of just ended there. So investigators instead decided to focus in on identifying the woman instead of looking for the murderer, looking for a match to any local missing women, and then they came across the name of Violet Kay, a 42-year-old from London who had moved to Brighton the year before with her boyfriend Tony Mancini. Now there's a few different reports I found of how Violet came to be on the police's radar in the first place. Some say that a random man reported that he hadn't seen Violet in her usual spot in the last couple of weeks. She was a sex worker. Others say they just happened to knock on the front door of Tony's home, 52 Kemp Street, which was only 5 minutes from Brighton Station. Police knocked on that front door and Tony apparently admitted that he hadn't seen Violet since May. But it was very clear quickly to investigators though that Violet was not Jane Doe. Violet, like I said, was 42, she was about 15 years older than they thought Jane Doe was. Plus, they found out that Violet had apparently sent her sister a telegram saying that she was leaving the UK to go and work abroad. The telegram simply reading, "Going abroad, good job, sail Sunday, will write, B." Interviews with Violet's mother also said that she had scars on her torso, and the torso at the station didn't have that. So Jane Doe was not Violet. But still, Violet was missing. She had kind of just disappeared. Tony Mancini was actually significantly younger than Violet, just 26 years old, and he had a very colourful history behind him, a criminal record including theft and loitering. He had a number of different aliases that he used to make it easier to commit his crimes, including Jack Notcher, Tony English, Homan Gold, and his actual birth name, Cecil Louis England. Tony Mancini was English to the core, but he used the name Mancini to make people think that he was an Italian gangster to install an element of fear, but he was just an Englishman. Tony and Violet's relationship was known to be an incredibly rocky one. It was not a healthy relationship in the slightest. Violet, as I said, was noted to be a sex worker and a dancer, and some speculate that Tony actually acted as more of a pimp than a boyfriend. He worked as a waiter and a bouncer in London, but also he had a lot of money for that. They moved to Brighton together in September 1933, so not even a year before the murders, and they lived at several addresses in Brighton together, sort of just bouncing from one to the other. Violet's last known address where she lived with Tony was a basement flat, 5 Park Crescent. The last time the couple were seen together, and actually the last time Violet was seen at all, was on the 10th of May 1934 at the Skylark Cafe on the seafront, where Tony worked as a handyman. Violet was said to be drunk, and she stormed into the cafe mid-shift to accuse Tony of having an affair with another waitress, teenager Elizabeth Attrell. The confrontation ended in Violet just storming out the cafe, and then she was never seen again. Not long after that, Tony moves to 52 Kemp Street, dragging a trunk along with him that people would have assumed at the time contained just all his belongings. Tony started telling people that the day after this very public argument they had, Violet fled to Paris and left him, and he quickly started just giving away all of her belongings. He just so happened to give all of Violet's stuff to teenage waitress Elizabeth, so it does seem kind of right that Violet was correct when it came to the affair accusation. He probably was having an affair with Elizabeth. But nobody really noticed or cared that Violet disappeared. That was until July 13th, when the police got a call from some workmen reporting a very horrible smell emanating from a room at a house they were painting, 52 Kemp Street, with the room being rented out by Tony Mancini. That's the second time Tony Mancini's name had popped up in a month, and now the police were paying attention and watching his house. The next day, they spoke with Tony again, but they didn't enter the property. They were just biding their time for some reason. But then Tony disappeared. When he didn't return back to the house for 24 hours, the landlady let the police in to search the room. And the workmen had been right. The room absolutely stank, with a smell coming from a large trunk at the base of the bed covered with a sheet and used as a coffee table. Visitors would later note how the trunk would drip a gross liquid, but nobody ever assumed the worst. Nobody ever thought there could be a body inside this trunk. Because of course, that's exactly what was inside. But this wasn't a dismembered body, nor was it the missing head and arms of Jane Doe as police kind of expected to find. It was the intact, decomposing body of Violet Kay, stuffed into a fetal position along with some clothes as well. They didn't know for sure that it was Violet when they very first opened it, but it was soon confirmed by her mother, who identified the body. This would have likely been just over 2 months after her death, if she had indeed died soon after the cafe argument. So 2 months on, and they finally knew what had become of Violet, only now it seemed that Tony himself had gone on the run, knowing that the jig was likely up. It wasn't long though until he was arrested in southeast London, where he immediately started denying being involved in Violet's death. After the discovery of Violet's body, the expertise of Sir Bernard Spilsbury was called upon once again, and he was brought back down to Brighton. He concluded that the cause of death was a skull fracture caused by a heavy, blunt weapon. The strike to the head was actually so strong that a piece of skull was found in her brain. This was a very violent attack, and it just so happened that police had also found a hammer in the room as well, and it kind of looked like somebody had made an attempt to burn it. The murder weapon, most likely. Tony Mancini's trial opened in December 1934 in Lewis Assizes in Brighton and lasted only 5 days. He was actually tried under one of his aliases, Jack Notcher, which was the name under which he was arrested, but we'll just continue to call him Tony to save any confusion. Now, you would think this would be a hole-in-one kind of trial. He's gone on the run, they found the body. The last time they were seen publicly was them having a massive argument. The prosecution, led by J.C. Castles, focused in on Violet's death and the burnt hammer as the murder weapon. They called in a graphologist, a writing expert of the time, to confirm that the handwriting on the telegram form sent to Violet's sister actually matched Tony's own handwriting. It was also proven that the telegram was sent from Brighton the morning after she'd likely died. One witness was called to testify that Tony had asked her to give a false alibi for when Violet was killed, and some of his friends also testified that he was boasting about hiding his missus just days after she was murdered. This all sounds like pretty watertight evidence, right? Well, apparently it was wrong. The defence counsel, Norman Burkett, pointed out that Violet was a sex worker, saying that she would bring her clients into her and Tony's home day in, day out, and there was no way to prove that Tony was the one who killed her. It was kind of a complete character assassination of Violet, very sadly. They admitted that Tony may have hidden Violet's body, which nowadays would be considered a crime in itself, but that shouldn't be proof of him murdering her. Tony had a criminal record. He knew the police would have immediately suspected him if he had gone to them saying that he'd found her murdered by a client. This was kind of the defence grasping at straws, but it was enough to stick doubt in the mind of the jurors, and that's all you need to do as a defence lawyer. And this was the 1930s. Living a respectable life was a very big thing. I mean, even now, almost a century later, we still see the negative treatment of sex workers, the stigma. Imagine how bad it was back then. Almost as soon as it was announced that Violet was a sex worker, there would have been no chance of justice. It was just a character assassination. But in fairness, there was also one piece of forensic evidence that raised questions as well. There was an item of Tony's clothing that was bloodstained entered into evidence by the prosecution. They said this must have been what he was wearing when Violet was killed. Only the defence were able to prove that this particular item had been bought after Violet's death. At the end of the 5-day trial, the jury deliberated for just over 2 hours before returning a verdict of not guilty. I mean, hats off to the defence because they did do very well. They did their job because this looked like it was going to be a slam dunk for the prosecution. Regardless of the character assassination, there probably wasn't enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Tony did it, even though it does seem very obvious. And that was that in this case for many, many years, until a deathbed confession over 3 decades later in 1976. In an interview with a journalist from the News of the World, Tony admitted that him and Violet had had a blazing row that night, and she apparently went to attack him with the hammer that he used to break coal for their fire. He said that he wrestled the hammer from her, but when she demanded it back, he threw it at her, hitting her on the left temple and killing her almost instantly. He said he was guilty of her death. He panicked and hid her body in the trunk, not wanting to part from her. If we do believe his story, it was likely more manslaughter than it was murder, but she died nonetheless and he got away with it. Do we believe his story? I don't know. I do think it's the closest to the truth we'll ever get. Perhaps it was accidental, this volatile couple having yet another blazing row and things going wrong. But then again, if Tony really was on his deathbed at this point and he wanted to clear his conscience, he probably didn't have anything to lose by admitting to everything, even if it was just a violent murder. Double jeopardy laws here in the UK at the time meant that even with a confession, Tony couldn't have been tried twice for a crime to which he had previously been acquitted. Tony was very safe at this point to admit to everything. He could have walked out of the courtroom and said, "Yes, I did it," and they still wouldn't have been able to do anything. He could have been prosecuted for perjury and lying under oath, but the authorities never really followed up on this. He was dying, there wasn't much point. And notably, whilst Tony did have a very lengthy criminal record, none of his crimes had ever been violent. But either way, it was a tragic death for Violet. Violet's murder case, whilst highly, highly unlikely to have been directly linked to the trunk found at Brighton Station, eclipsed the first case, and Jane Doe was never identified. I would love to be able to do my usual spiel and say that with DNA technology, I'm sure that one day we might get an identity, but I've covered multiple times before the complications around genetic genealogy here in the UK. It's not really something that's done here unless it's considered to be an absolute last resort. No other options in a very important and usually current case. I don't know if an 88-year-old murder will fall under that umbrella. Neither of the women here got justice, not Jane Doe nor Violet, so it's a very sad case all around. So Violet's case is, I suppose, technically solved, but also technically unsolved. Jane Doe, we don't know her name, nor do we know her killer. I am inclined to believe that potentially it did have something to do with her pregnancy, but perhaps she, again, like Violet, was a sex worker. Perhaps she just found herself in a very violent situation with no way to get out. I suppose by this point, we'll probably never know, but I really, really hope that we do. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.